Hi, this is Jennifer Kemp, and I'm here today with Marissa Meltzer, author of the book Girl Power, The 90s Revolution in Music. So tell us about the book. How did it come about?
A few years ago, Sleater-Kinney broke up or went on long-term hiatus, and I was turning 29 and sort of looking back, and they were a band, obviously, that's very beloved in Portland, and they were a band that also was really important to my own coming of age. And I started kind of taking stock and thinking, you know, they broke up, and at the same time, the Pussycat Dolls were topping the charts, and it seemed like maybe Britney Spears was going to do something really rash. And I just wondered if everything that I had held so dear in the 90s was just going away without a fight. And so it really made me kind of look back, and I started out with just kind of my own early teen years, which happened to coincide with Riot Girl, and worked my way forward.
Okay. So yeah, I guess you talked a little bit about what it covers. What kind of reactions have you had to the book?
They've been great. I think on one level, it's been good for girls who like that music or who came of age listening to 90s music by women, just to feel like their history is being told and to just relive it on a purely nostalgic level, which I don't really have a problem with. But on an even, I would say, greater level, I've heard from girls who were, you know, born in the 90s, who didn't really live any of it firsthand, who just feel so excited by some of the messages of, you know, bands like Bikini Kill, or the idea that they could start a riot or a revolution of their own. And that's what makes me really thrilled, because I hope that they're going to take the message away, that they can, you know, take action in their own lives and do something for themselves.
Yeah, for sure. So your intended audience was like both women that are adults today and kind of were around during the Riot Girl era, and like girls growing up right now?
Yeah, I definitely thought that girls who are around my age, I'm 32, would definitely be into it, and, you know, a little older and a little younger. But my previous book about Sassy Magazine, I thought that the only kinds of people that would have wanted to read it were girls who had loved Sassy and read it as teenagers like I had. But I had heard so much from girls who, you know, were way too young to have ever read it and started buying them on eBay and were just so excited by it. And so I kind of had a suspicion that it might be the same thing with this book, especially since something like music is so accessible. You know, you can go and buy albums, and you might not start a zine, although plenty of people do and are, but you could definitely start a blog, you know.
Yeah, definitely. So talk about your personal connections to the Riot Girl movement.
I was growing up in a small college town in California, and I was an only child, and I think my fantasy of having siblings is that they just give you all kinds of cool stuff to know about and do. I know that's not necessarily true, but so I was really into pop culture because that was sort of my kind of older sibling figure that was telling me about cool stuff. And I got really into music and sort of like in junior high, or, you know, listening to The Smiths and The Cure and all of that. And I also read several magazines, including Sassy, very religiously, and saw these pictures around the time I was 15, in around 1992, of, you know, these Riot Girls. And I hadn't even heard any of their music because, you know, back then, pictures traveled faster than albums did. And I just remember having a really visceral reaction. Like, I didn't go about knowing that that was something that I wanted in my life, but I saw it and just knew that it was going to be sort of this outlet or this answer for me. So I, you know, bought the albums and went to go see all of the Riot Girl bands play, and I had a zine, and I eventually had a band that was very short-lived in college. And I never went to any, you know, Riot Girl meetings or anything like that, but I feel like that kind of feminism and that feeling of a teenage revolution, kind of imbued everything I did as an adolescent. I'm just so glad that I had it in my life.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds like a really cool experience and like a good time to be kind of coming of age. So just for like listeners that don't know as much about Riot Grrrl, can you talk about like the attributes of the movement and like what kind of music it was?
It was a feminist underground punk movement, which is amazing because, you know, how many movements are there, period, and how many are sort of specifically for young women? It was born from the punk communities in Olympia in Washington and in Washington, D.C., where there was a really fertile punk scene, but it wasn't a particularly hospitable place to be a girl in a band. And I think that women in the scene were just increasingly frustrated by that fact and decided to eventually band together and start zines and start bands and start having meetings together to sort of both improve their communities and also to try to improve the experience of girlhood on kind of a greater level. And its message spread very quickly.
Okay. So you talk about in the book how in a lot of ways Riot Grrrl gets appropriated and misappropriated by the mainstream media. Like, talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, it was one of those things where pictures of girls who were writing things like slut across their stomach, which Riot Grrrls did as sort of a reappropriation or, you know, a way to kind of call attention to negative words that might be lobbed at them, or girls in bikinis and shredded fishnets as kind of was their style, was very provocative. And so it got a lot of coverage in the mainstream media. Unfortunately, a lot of that coverage was really sensationalistic and kind of made them seem silly, needlessly angry, naive. Plus, I think that whole era, we were all just less media savvy. You know, suddenly there are these pictures of you and your friends in a magazine, and you just really don't have, I think, the basis for dealing with that we might have now. Plus, I think all of our expectations as a culture of what privacy we deserved were completely different than they are now.
Yeah, I guess that's true, because now we have, like, the internet, and we're just, like, bombarded by pictures all the time.
Yeah,
so
Facebook.
Yeah, it's hard for me to even picture.
People can Google you. Yeah, I can't imagine what that must have felt like for them at all. It must have been extremely alienating.
Yeah, for sure. Like, they had totally, like, the negative impressions of the Riot Grrrls, but also you talk about how things that, like, were started by people like Kathleen Hanna, like, girl power, became, like, adopted by the Spice Girls, and they just, like, turned the message around and whatnot.
Yeah, well, girl power was on the cover of Bikini Kill's self-titled zine, you know, I think in 1992 or 1993. Who knows what the first use ever of girl power was. But, you know, back then it was a term about the sort of, you know, empowerment of young women. And as the years went on, I think that Riot Grrrl message was something like a butterfly effect, where it was a relatively small, relatively short-lived movement, but it had these, you know, really great repercussions throughout really mainstream culture. So, you know, suddenly you started seeing things like girl baby tees and girl lip gloss, and you could buy barrettes that the Riot Grrrls favored everywhere all of a sudden, you know, Urban Outfitters and places like that. And slowly but surely, bands like Alanis Morissette, who had sort of a Riot Grrrl light, like more kind of filtered and maybe camera-ready rage, were getting signed and getting really popular. And then eventually you have the Spice Girls, who are shouting girl power all the time. And I think for those of us who had come of age during Riot Grrrl, it was kind of like, what?
Yeah.
You know, did they know? You know, did they take it? Who knows? I'm not sure anyone will ever be able to answer whether or not the Spice Girls would have existed without Riot Grrrl, whether they stole girl power or not. But I certainly make a case in my book that, you know, the girl power of Riot Grrrl, the girl power of, you know, some other bands, particularly in the UK that used it, were around and got enough cult coverage that someone surely could have been like, that's going to be our motto for this band that we're manufacturing.
Yeah, I'm with you on that theory. I think that's
right. I'm not a natural conspiracy theorist, but I'll go there.
Yeah. So do you think this is like pretty typical of underground movements? Because I feel like, I don't know, like the hippie movement got really appropriated and like the punk music and like even like grunge got really appropriated. Or do you think this is kind of like a unique ripoff of Riot Grrrl?
I think that it's pretty inevitable that underground movements get appropriated and chewed up and spit out by the mainstream. I think that the way that it happened with Riot Grrrl is just really interesting, partially because it began with such a strong political ethos and ended, on being chewed up by the media in such a completely apolitical, way. I think its story hasn't been told enough. And so, it's really interesting.
Yeah. So that brings me to another question. This is a little bit, kind of a sticky subject because, like, the Riot Grrrls personally, like, blacked out the media because they didn't want to talk to anybody. So, how do you feel about that? What happens? And, do you think that they intentionally didn't want their stories told?
Well, they decided to have this media blackout after being kind of, burned by several articles in the mainstream media, which is, it's almost unfathomable to think of a media blackout now, and very powerful and kind of exciting. And I can certainly understand why they did it. I mean, I think that that was all that they knew how to do, and it was a powerful move. But at the same time, with the blessing of hindsight, I would say that it was unfortunate because I think that the power of Riot Grrrl and the message of Riot Grrrl could have really been beneficial for girls, across America, across the world. As it was, it was pretty short-lived and only covered a little bit. And I know it certainly had repercussions in, women who read about it in places like Newsweek or Rolling Stone and started listening to bands and really had their lives changed. And I think that that could have happened on an even greater level. I also think that, they could have maybe learned to work with the mainstream on some level. I think about somebody like Michael Pollan, who's become a face of the food movement and eating locally and cleanly and simply. And those ideas have been certainly percolating in, left-wing, hippie-ish culture. It's the way my parents ate for a number of decades. And yet he's, in many ways, become the mouthpiece for it. I'm sure there are plenty of people who don't think his message is radical enough. But the fact that he's, in the New York Times or on Oprah, I think has such a potential to really change people's lives. And, I think that if Riot Grrrl had had some kind of compromise or some sort of public face like that, it could have done a lot of good. But when you're in the middle of it, what's to say?
Yeah. Like you said, 2020 hindsight, they had exactly. No idea about Alanis Morissette or Liz Phair or the Spice Girls or what was going to happen with it. So
yeah, and they were really young. I mean, I think most of them were college age, so that's not necessarily your greatest concern. I can definitely understand their motives.
Yeah. So speaking of which, a lot of being a Riot Grrrl is just being a girl, just really playful with the barrettes and the Hello Kitty and all that stuff. I was wondering, how well does that age? Can adult women still be true to this Riot Grrrl ethos, even if maybe, they have a day job and they're not in a band? Is that sustainable?
Oh, absolutely. I think that childlike part of Riot Grrrl was really a nod to kind of your joyous pre-adolescent youth. There was a lot in culture, with books like Reviving Ophelia about how confident girls were before they were sort of ruined by puberty and and boys. And so I think some of that, the kind of playground songs and the barrettes and the little baby doll dresses were maybe a nod to that. And it's also fun. I mean, third wave feminism was about how it's okay to be a girl, and you can shave your legs, and you can also be a feminist, and you can go to the mall, and you can, you know, sing about boys, and you can still be a feminist. It was a way of, I think, differentiating yourself from maybe your mother's feminism. But, you know, does that aesthetic age well? Not entirely. I've been known to rock a baby doll dress from time to time, but, you know, I think that maybe it's the kind of thing that you carry in your heart. And, you know, I think also part of maybe being a grown up riot girl or whatever is, you know, yeah, not necessarily needing to wear a certain clothes. But ultimately, the message of Riot Girl was that you don't have to look a certain way or be in a band or write a zine. You know, you just had to sort of live it and believe it and want to make the world a better place for women, you know, sort of through punk. And, you know, it was about taking action, but it wasn't prescriptive. There were many ideas of ways in which you could change the world, but there were no checklists, which is great. I think that it was so open, and it gave girls a lot of freedom to really try on roles and learn how to be themselves.
Yeah, which is really cool. Like, later you talk about how, like, the whole, like, girl power of, like, the mid-90s was really commercial, and it's like, oh, if you don't have the right miniskirt and the right lip gloss, you're not, you know, a powerful girl. But Riot Girl seems like it was a lot more individualistic.
I think so. I perhaps, you know, to an outside observer or something, it could have looked like all the girls were the same or dressed the same, but I think it was much more probably diverse than people might have given them credit for. And certainly when you look at something like the Spice Girls or any of the sort of subsequent pop bands, you know, those are much more about consuming culture and buying a set of, you know, Spice dolls and, you know, and, you know, learning to be a good consumer, not learning to be a radical.
Yeah. So you talk about a very small, specific group of people in music in the beginning of the book, the Riot Girls. Mm-hmm. And then you go on to broaden your scope to the national and the international scale. How did you choose that format?
You know, it's funny. I've never really had anyone put it that way before, so I haven't really thought about it that way. But I wanted to start with Riot Girl partially because the book was just really personal in terms of which bands I covered and sort of how I framed the narrative. Riot Girl was sort of, for me, the beginning of my, like, musical feminist awakening, and it also coincided with sort of my early teen years, so it seemed like a good place to start. And also, it was this, you know, very, very intense, very short-lived movement, and it was something that I kept coming back to. So I thought it was important to tell the story in the beginning so that I could continue to reference it at the end.
Okay.
And so I think the book slowly opens up and kind of, it's maybe like V-shaped. Like, it starts with this sort of small punk scene and goes on to, like, you know, larger, more well-known rock acts, and then you get to more, like, a larger and larger pop world by the end.
Yeah, that's how I thought of it too, actually. And so you don't really write about this in the book, but, like, do you see any small and vibrant scenes such as Riot Girl that are happening today?
Not that I know of, but again, I'm 32, and I'm probably not as adventurous or, you know, plugged in as I perhaps once was, and I'm maybe a little too nostalgic too. It's definitely not one of my perhaps always most productive traits. But I think that, you know, there are always cities like Portland that have amazing music scenes and certainly tons of really strong women in it. I think that in some ways they're not quite as vital as maybe they once were, because you can, you know, record songs in your bedroom and put them up online, and you can start, you know, a MySpace so that people can listen to them, and you can, you know, sort of have it develop organically from your bedroom in some ways. Not that, you know, the camaraderie of fellow bands and playing shows or anything is any substitution, but I think that there's there's a lot more potential to live somewhere that isn't necessarily the hotbed of a cool scene. And certainly I hope that there are many, you know, groups of girls making amazing music that I know nothing about that will come to the forefront soon. I mean, there are certainly bands like, you know, I like Vivian Girls and the Dum Dum Girls. I like Best Coast quite a bit, and Mika Miko were really great, but, you know, they're all kind of spread out, so I look forward to whatever's next.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know, I see a lot of music coming out of Portland, but maybe it's not political in the same way.
Yeah, I think that that's a problem across the board. I did a reading in New York about a week ago with Allison Wolf from Bratmobile, one of the, you know, pioneering bands of Riot Girl, and she said that one of her great frustrations was that music wasn't more political, and it shocked her that in the Bush era, you know, we had 8 years of that, and there still wasn't political music. If people were going to be pissed off and singing about it, that really would have been the time.
Yeah, for sure.
So, you know, that's something I miss, too. I miss the political music and angry female artists, you know, which is something I also just, I don't quite see it or feel it the way that I did in the 90s. I mean, but I don't know. Courtney Love Hole has a new album coming out in March. So I feel somewhat cynical, but maybe I'll cross my fingers for that. I also think Taylor Swift is kind of angry in her own way. So, you know, I'm thinking that maybe some of those pop singers will grow up and you know, they certainly have plenty of things to be mad about. So,
yeah,
I'm excited to see what's next. I try to be an optimist.
So do you consider it worthy of criticism when women in music such as Liz Phair or the Spice Girls have refused to take a political stance, especially a feminist stance?
It's something that on a personal level, I always feel a little bit betrayed by. You know, I want women to identify as feminist, partly because I have always, it's never something I've questioned, and I've never really understood why it's a hard thing for other women. And I always get very excited when people do identify as such. At the same time, you know, I've never really been in a band, and I can imagine that it is really annoying to have to talk about your gender in every interview, or to be in a band that also contains guys in it, and you can be like, you can guess which are the questions that girls will ask. You know, it's still treated as something of a novelty, and it's still something that women have to address. And I can see not wanting to have your gender, you know, be an issue anymore and just not wanting to discuss it. But, you know, bands or artists or anyone who describes themselves as feminist always gets extra points from me.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I mean, I feel that. But on the other hand, it seems like there are a lot of women in music that just want to be musicians, the mm-hmm. way guys can just be musicians, and yeah, like they're not politicians.
Yeah. I mean, and they're not politicians, they're musicians, and you know, I can see why that's something that they want. It's a fine line to sort of have to tread and balance. I'm not sure that I would be, you know, wary 24 hours a day of my potential role modelhood. Sometimes you just want to speak for yourself.
Yeah. So you talk about raunch culture, a term mm-hmm. used in Ariel V's book, Female Chauvinist Pigs. It basically came to an apex in the late 90s and early 2000s with the influences of the likes of Britney Spears and the Pussycat Dolls. Do you see that trend continuing today, or do you think it's already kind of peaked and is dying down in music and fashion?
I want to think it's peaked. Although, you know, that sort of raunch, oversexed culture doesn't seem to be going away. It definitely seems like when Ariel Levy's book came out, it was really kind of at a high point. But, you know, I mean, I think of somebody like Kendra Wilkinson, I don't even know what her married name is, but that former playmate who was on, you know, the Playboy reality show, who's now on the cover of like Us Weekly all the time for being a mom. Like, I feel like in some ways that's how deep it goes, you know, or somebody like Kim Kardashian, who essentially became famous for having a sex tape. It's, you know, we're so used to raunch culture that we don't always see its roots. I do think that there has lately been a bit of a trend towards niceness in culture and nice girls. And, you know, ABC Family has a number of teen shows about good girls, like The Secret Life of the American Teen. Taylor Swift is a very good girl in terms of pop culture role models. You know, fashion has been a little less oversexed for teenagers and a little more prim. But again, that's it's a fashion, all of that, you know, the good sort of archetype, just like being bad is. And I think the pressure to be good and to be nice is just as potentially pernicious as being bad or being sexy.
Yeah.
They're all just, you know, pretty stifling boxes and roles that, you know, young girls are supposed to fit into. And the reality is that young women and no women, no people really fit into those very easily. And one of the things that was so, I think, liberating about Riot Girl for me as a teenager was that, you know, you could be angry and you could be experimenting with kind of being slutty and clothes wise, and you could be sing-songy, and you could, you know, love candy and your friends and rail against the patriarchy all at the same time. And it didn't mean that you were good or bad or happy or sad or, you know, anything. You were just being yourself.
Yeah, well, I'm about out of questions, but if you have anything else that you'd like to talk about.
No, I think we've covered a lot. It's been really fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming.